All right, I know we've still got some people coming back into the room, but I do want to be cognizant of the time with the weather. We had a great discussion in the first panel, which went a little bit long. As I announced before, Nancy Ann DeParle is not going to be able to join us today, but we are going to try to have continue this full and frank discussion in our second panel. A lot more to cover in the next hour or so. And I want to reorient everyone who's here by just taking them again back to our overall agenda. We spent the past hour plus focusing on some of the practical issues for accountable care from the standpoint of patients or consumers or persons and engagement on that side. And now we're going to turn more to the provider side. And this is where the significant payment changes are occurring that are intended to drive this, what people have called cultural change, which I think of as more about really supporting changes in care delivery. And for all the criticism that the name accountable care has come in for already today, this is where the accountable in ACO comes from. The point is that these organizations for delivering care are on a track to become accountable, not just for the volume and intensity of services that they provide, but for improving quality of care and health while reducing costs for their patients and the overall healthcare system. At the core of this concept is not accountability for its own sake, but providing an effective means for supporting providers in their best efforts to improve quality of care and reduce costs. You can think of it as a reward. I think of it as really support. As we heard about earlier today, a lot of steps around care coordination, around getting it right for a particular patient, around putting the person at the center of care, a lot of those steps just aren't reimbursed in traditional healthcare systems, and we've seen, especially with rising budget pressures, the difficulty of making piecemeal changes in those systems to expand fee-for-service or something like that don't seem to be getting us there. So accountable care takes another approach, and it starts with this concept of shared savings. Because providers that are now tracking the overall results for their patients get a share of the savings when they reduce overall cost trends while improving quality, that's what drives the additional support for these reforms in care delivery. And that notion of shared savings is what Don Berwick this morning called a core model for how CMS is thinking about and moving forward on implementing the ACO program. These steps are intended to make improvements in care more sustainable in a way that current reimbursement systems do not. Providers have many ideas about how to improve care, how to get costs down, remove unnecessary costs, but often they're swimming against the financial tide, and it's harder to make ends meet in their practice when they're taking this extra time or taking this effort to reform care delivery or make investments in changing their practice. And so that's what the accountable care payment reform side is intended to address. The most basic version of this is the so-called one-sided shared savings model, which may operate within a fee-for-service environment, if that's sort of the baseline on which this new payment stream or new payment track is being added. It means no new risk for losses if spending continues to go up without improvements in trends. It's just an opportunity if reductions in spending trends occur along with the kinds of measured improvements in care that we've already heard about today. It's an opportunity for new resources. Now, many people view this as a relatively straightforward way of starting to implement ACOs. In fact, in some of our previous papers, we've described a stepwise approach to ACOs starting here, starting where many organizations that are trying to improve care and lower costs are likely to be in 2012, where they have limited availability of IT infrastructure and support for these kinds of care improvement efforts, and it can be a first step, an incremental way of moving into a different way of being paid. You know, think of it as having two tracks for payment starting to operate at the same time. So we're still barreling down the traditional payment track with fee-for-service payments or whatever PPO arrangements are already in place. But in addition to that, there's a separate track set up where providers are now starting to be explicitly paid based on tracking and improving overall results for patients, patient experience, and overall cost trends. And the shared savings approach just adds that onto the existing payment track. For these ACOs, many implementation issues have already come up. Even this kind of step is viewed by many, and understandably so, as a real change. Don Berwick outlined a number of these kinds of challenges for implementation, things like how ACO incentives can be aligned with other reforms, things like medical homes, IT payments that are coming along now, movements towards episode payments, other steps that can help provide more of the upfront resources needed to support these cultural and delivery changes. There are a range of other issues as well. How do you attribute beneficiaries to an ACO? What are the antitrust implications? And do the antitrust authorities like DOJ and FTC need to provide more guidance going beyond what they already have produced on issues like assessing the benefits of coordination on the one hand and integration versus the risks of market power on the other? These are all very important issues, and we've done a number of events and written a lot on them, as well as many others recently. I want to highlight one further issue, though, that's at the top, was at the very top of Don's list, and that was specifically the issue of including some element of downside risk. That may be a technical term for putting more of the payment weight for providers on decreasing costs, trends, and improving quality by placing them at some financial risk. I would think of it, though, as how much weight you keep on that traditional payment track, the one that's based on fee-for-service or the way that reimbursement has traditionally gone for the providers in an ACO, versus moving to the second new track that's based on, as best we can, measuring results, measuring patient experience, and measuring impacts on cost trends. So there are a couple of versions of this. One is a so-called two-sided or symmetric risk model in which payments are still predominantly going to be based on that traditional model, but they also include the provider groups being at risk for losses if spending exceeds the projected benchmark. So that's a stronger incentive potentially for keeping costs down, and maybe more support from the businesses or the other payers that are involved in these reforms for confidence that the provider group's really going to take steps to improve care, to transform care. This is still a relatively limited disruption from, or relatively limited discontinuity from, traditional payment systems. Going further than that would be a partial capitation model, where more of that weight in the traditional payment system is moved over to this second new track that's now running in parallel. So instead of having full fee-for-service payments or full PPO payments, some portion of those funds would go over to this new track that's based on results of care and that gives providers more flexibility in how they change the delivery of care to, and how they can provide financial support for that in the implementation of the ACO. So these are two different versions of so-called downside risk, with putting more weight on more flexibility in how providers can deliver care. But at the same time, it means more of a movement away from traditional payment systems and traditional ways of delivering care. As we and others have written about this in the past, one way to think about this movement might be tying moving more of the dollars over to greater flexibility for providers and using it to reform care, to implement the kinds of steps that you've heard about already today, when they have a better capacity in place to demonstrate that they're actually tracking patients well and they're actually improving care, particularly for vulnerable patients and the like. So these movements may occur in tandem, the financial reforms along with delivery system reforms and supports for changes in the way that care actually occurs, more extensive IT capabilities, more extensive coordination capabilities, demonstrated ability to help
patients get to the best providers for their own needs and so forth. So over time, as care quality and technical support systems and IT systems get better, ACOs could implement payment models with increasingly more risk, giving them more resources to change the way that care is delivered, more financial support for those changes, and moving to payments that are increasingly based on results, not just volume and intensity. Now, as with many other complicated undertakings that involve both process changes, changes in the way that care is delivered, cultural changes, and financial changes, this may be a gradual process. People may start with very relatively limited changes and move forward from there as capacities improve on both the care delivery side, the performance measurement side, and the financing to support it. But this raises some important questions. How quickly can it be done? How confident, how can CMS and Medicare beneficiaries be confident that the risk, these risk-related reforms or these shifts of more of the weight of financing into supporting better care directly are actually achieving the intended results and not just simply providing, as was talked about earlier, a new label for supporting organizations that have easier patient populations or would have had lower costs anyway. Once again, with all of these issues, we're not starting from scratch in answering the questions. There are a number of efforts to implement ACO-related reforms right now that are already moving down some of the tracks that I was just describing in the last few minutes, that are incorporating some significant shifts away from traditional reimbursement models and towards paying more for better care. Under the ACA, the Medicare Shared Savings Program also includes a potential opportunity to build in this more significant shift in payment models, and a number, as I said, of private plans are already taking steps in this direction. So these are some of the topics that we want to cover today. And, in fact, a couple of the panelists on the stage with me from Blue Shield of California and Atrius Health, as well as some of our own pilot sites in the Brookings-Dartmouth ACO Collaborative, provide some perspectives on the experiences with implementing these kinds of payment reforms in practice and what needs to go along with them to make them a success. How do you actually do changes in delivery, reforms, real reform in healthcare delivery, along with real reform and payments as effectively as possible? How do you set the spending benchmarks to determine expected costs? How do you address these the risk issues that are beyond the control of providers, those related to the underlying risks of the patient populations or just to bad luck in a particular year? Can risk corridors or risk adjustment systems help with that, and how can they best be designed? How can other steps be implemented for improving care at the same time as ACOs are being implemented so that providers have confidence that these payment reforms and these delivery reforms really are going to be sufficient to move forward together? Now, questions like these are not going to be settled today. They're going to continue in the months ahead. But it's important to take steps forward now. Private plans, states are doing this now. We heard about Medicaid in New Jersey at length this morning. A number of private plans around the country are doing this. Medicare has implemented some of these ideas in pilots, and as we've already heard, they're required to do more in the coming years. And given the pressures of rising healthcare costs, the gaps in quality, the frustration among both providers and patients, we really need to find ways forward to help support their efforts to deliver greater value in health. So with this tight timeline in mind, we're going to try to get practical in the next hour. What should be included in the CMS regulations for ACOs around these issues, particularly for organizations that really are ready, feel like they're ready to redirect resources in a more significant way, not just set up this second track focusing on results? What are some other related reforms that can help support the goals of ACOs? So this is a tough journey, but it's one that we need to move forward on now. We need to do it right, moving from concepts to specific steps. So that's what we're going to cover in the panel today, and you've heard we have a very distinguished set of panelists to help us get through these issues. I'm going to start. You're going to hear next from John Burtko, who's a guest scholar here at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform, and he's going to provide an overview of some of these more technical issues. And John's really really working hard to translate a lot of these actuarial technical details into the important practical implications for care delivery. After we hear from John, Ed Samaras, who is the chief actuary at Blue Shield of California, which is currently implementing an ACO-type pilot in Sacramento, will give us some perspectives from his experience. John Goodman, also with us today, is the president and the CEO of the National Center for Policy Analysis, and he has written prolifically on a variety of ways in which healthcare providers are trying to change the way that care is being delivered and the kinds of payment changes that might feasibly support those reforms in delivery. So we're going to hear his perspective, too. And Gene Lindsay, the president and CEO of Atrius Health, which is participating in the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts alternative quality contract, also has some direct experiences on these issues. So that's where we're going to go. Same kind of format as last time. After we hear from these opening comments from John, we're going to hear some perspectives from the other panelists, have a little bit of discussion, and then open it up to all of you again. So with that, thank you, and I'd like to turn this over to John Burko.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. As Mark said, I'm an actuary, so I will try to keep you awake during this period as opposed to the usual technique of most actuaries. One thing is that we get paid for measuring things, and that's what I'll try to do and describe, one, how we can be fair to both provider groups, doctors in particular on one side, and to CMS and the Medicare Trust Fund on the other side. And so I'm not going to talk so much about the budget setting mechanism today because there are several options for doing that, but think of the budget as being set generally on the basis of the history of claims that get associated with the people who would be in an ACO. But rather the more technical aspect of, well, what if the population changes? How do you measure how sick they are? And that is a term that's usually called risk adjustment. And what I want to bring today is 20 years of experience working with this, including 10 while I was both at a private insurer and then more recently working with Mark and Elliot here in terms of the way risk adjustment has evolved and developed over the last few years. A couple of things to note here. Among the populations that you can do risk adjustment with, seniors are the best, and that's because they're the sickest. They have lots of chronic conditions. I think Elliot's work and his crew have shown that seniors visit some provider on basis of about 93% of them every year. So there's lots of visits there to measure what's going on with them. The next part is, as I said, CMS has had a fair amount of experience with risk adjustment methodology. First started on a very primitive basis in 2000, but since 2004, we've had an encounter-based risk adjustment system. That also means, though, that Medicare Advantage plans and many, many providers have had the experience of collecting the diagnostic data and, more importantly, submitting that data stream in. And so this all depends on how good the data streams are and how well claims and diagnostic information has been organized and collected. You could ask, is risk adjustment good enough? And I would say, yes, it works pretty well. It works really well for groups of people. And in the law is the minimum 5,000 people to be in an accountable care organization for seniors. I found that when I was in my practice and I did a lot of work with Medicare Advantage groups there, that was a very stable group of people. The predictive power of that is fairly high. It's up in the 70 to 80% range for a group. On an individual basis, as you look to one person or another, it's much lower, but there have been improvements over the years. Most importantly, prescription drug data is a very good add-on. The current risk adjuster used by CMS doesn't use it, but the data is now out there for the last 4 years. So we could grab and insert that data with there. One thing that Deborah alluded to that I'll say is you worry about, does risk adjustment work well enough for the sickest people? And there's another technical term called the predictive ratio, which is how much does the risk adjustment mechanism pay for a given person that's pretty sick, say a senior with congestive heart failure. The good news is for most of those kinds of procedures, the predictive ratios are really close to 1.0, which means they pay very close to the amount that on average is needed for an individual. Now, I probably have to give you one of my bad actuarial jokes. Did you hear about the actuary who drowned because when he walked across San Francisco Bay, on average, the bay was only 3 feet deep? Okay, thank you. So on average works pretty well for the whole group of people, and of course it doesn't work perfectly for individuals. One of the things that's very important, I think, that was alluded to or mentioned by Don Berwick and then alluded to by Deborah was the way whether you do prospective or retrospective attribution, and that's closely connected to the need for risk adjustment. On the retrospective side, that is, you look at what happened over the last year, you assign providers to patients based on the actual treatment patterns, and then you do the measurement. The physician group practice demo uses that kind of a measurement method to see how well things worked. It does a very good job of assigning people to the providers, the physicians in particular, that they actually saw, but it violates one of, I think, what Deborah's principles were, is notifying. Nobody knows. The doctors don't know who their patients are going to be. They know who their panel is, of course, but they don't know whether a certain patient was part of the ACO measurement group or not. Second part of a way to do this is prospectively. And I have to say I'm biased in favor of prospective methods in most cases. And so in this case, you would know who your patients are based on perhaps 12 or 24 months of claim history. Again, Elliot and his team's work have shown a high degree of loyalty of patients to the care systems. I think, Elliot, it was in there, what, 75% or so range. So people do stay in general with the care systems they're in. So A, you can know who the people are. B, you can notify the physicians. C, you can notify the patients, you know, that they are in this care system. It could be made voluntary, if you like. And then I think most importantly, in my consulting with physicians and hospital systems, but physicians in particular, they're achievement-oriented. And so you can tell them, if your patients are like that, you can then monitor and manage what the actual to predicted experience should be, and things then get moved around. I say Jay's back in the room here, and I hope you're going to nod, Jay, when I say you guys do budgets for your individual physician groups and pods and measure them, and if something goes wrong or they're out of sight, you nod, I hope, when they say they fix it along the way. He's nodding. I think that's kind of an overview of all this. The tool is out there, and I think we are ready to use it. I would look to Ed here if he wants to make some comments about how that's been used. In my experience, I worked for a very large private insurer, and we used versions of risk adjustment for capitated medical groups. The groups wanted to be paid an appropriate amount, and we needed to be fair to them because we didn't want them to run away and not be part of our system. They wanted to be fair so that they could be paid the right amounts for the group of patients they were treating. Okay, thank you.
In California around accountable care.
Very good. Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always good to get a taste of some different weather. You know, I live in San Francisco, and so we don't have that stuff falling from the sky too often. So I thought I'd start. California has a long history of managed care, and Don Berwick, you know, mentioned that, you know, we can't have amnesia here. We have to learn from the past. And Mark talked about, you know, this accountability over time and starting, having a starting point that's, you know, grounded in where we're at. So the providers in California have been taking risk, as I said, for a long time under both Medicare program and commercial HMO. I think right now there's about 8 million covered lives in commercial HMOs. that on the physician side are fully at risk. They have full capitation, multi-specialty capitation. So the physicians are fully at risk for the care that they provide. There's, I think, probably order of magnitude 500,000 members in the MAPD program where they're taking risk. So there's, you know, there's been quite a long track record of that. And as a result, infrastructure, you know, to effectively coordinate care, I think we've been talking about integrating care, you know, has been developed over the years that it's come from both medical groups and the independent practice associations that, you know, are under these arrangements. However, there's also been some tough lessons along the road, and I think in the late 90s there were a whole rash of physician organization bankruptcies that highlighted the need for some oversight, you know, over these groups that, you know, in effect were acting as mini insurance companies. One of our current congresswomen, the second most famous one, Jackie Speier, sponsored legislation when she was in the California legislature that created a financial solvency standards board. So this was back in year 2000 to advise the regulators about solvency for these risk-bearing organizations and how that should be managed. I was one of the original appointees. I was actually appointed by Gray Davis, just to give you a time frame for how long ago that was. And I think what we found in that process was that some basic steps for an organization that's taking on risk, like having an audited financial statement, was important, that they have IBNR calculations with, you know, which took into account liabilities they have outstanding for care that was provided by maybe their specialty network that they've referred to, that they have to have positive surplus, you know, essentially be solvent, and they have some reporting process going on regularly. And I think those steps have really helped really lessen the number of provider insolvencies that have been experienced. And right now that board, which I'm still a member of, is looking at what kind of rules California should have around solvency for ACO organizations. So this is a timely topic on a lot of fronts. I thought I'd make another comment, too. The results of capitation, you know, have been a little bit mixed on another front, too. For Blue Shield of California, you know, our business is roughly 50% PPO, 50% HMO. You know, a little changes a little bit over time. But when we compared on a risk-adjusted basis how the HMO delivery system was comparing to the PPO, you know, we found that, you know, roughly a third of the areas that we looked at, there were clear cost advantages through the HMO delivery system. Another third, you know, it's kind of within the statistical variation, and there you couldn't draw a firm conclusion. And then another third, where the HMO delivery system was actually less cost effective than the PPO. And also, those latter areas were pretty typically in areas where the capitation rate had gone up pretty dramatically, you know, over the recent years, really through negotiating leverage because of, you know, conditions in those areas. Now, our most recent pilot that's going on currently is with our largest customer, CalPERS. And it's in conjunction with the Hill Physician Group and the Catholic Healthcare West hospitals in the Sacramento area. So there's roughly 40,000 CalPERS members that are part of that. It's sort of an attribution model within an HMO model, if that works for people, because we really have a broader population there, you know, order of magnitude 200,000 members in Northern California. And the ones that are using these providers, you know, are part of this model. In conjunction with CalPERS, we set a target of keeping healthcare costs flat year over year from in 2010 compared to 2009. And you know, all three organizations, Blue Shield, Hill Physicians, NCHW, really stepped up to commit to that and have taken on, all of us have taken on significant risk. I think order of magnitude on the hospital side, they signed up for $10 million of risk, you know, to make sure that this happened and they could deliver these results. The way that these buckets of risk are apportioned, which is kind of the devil in the details, it's really around the areas that the different parties to this contract, you know, have the most impact on those cost areas. So there's a whole matrix of risk share by different medical areas, and it has really been surprisingly successful. I think my team, you know, is overseeing the analytics of this, and in our last look, it really looks like they're going to hit their target, which, compared to the rest of the Northern California results, is the trend. The medical trend is roughly 8% lower than, which kind of in our business we rarely get a good control group, but this is as close to a good control group as we get. So their results they've gotten a little help from a mild flu season, but I think they've really done a great job, and the results have been there. So I look forward to maybe talking a little bit more about this as we get into some of the questions.
Great. Ed, thanks for telling us about some of your experience. John, maybe I could turn to you next. You've written a lot about a range of things going way outside the bounds of just integrated and coordinated care that could lead to significant reductions in costs. You know, Ed talked about some big cost savings that they're seeing from their approach. Significant reductions in costs, improvements in quality. I'd like you to maybe talk to us a little bit about how you see those payment reforms going forward and how it may or may not fit with some of these ACO reforms.
Let me see it here, go up there.
Whichever you'd rather.
All right, let me just, okay. I can see the audience a little bit.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
Am I on here? No. I put a post up on my blog yesterday, and I said I'm going into the lion's den at the Brookings Institution tomorrow. And I'm not going to be one of the lions. A lot of people believe in evidence-based medicine. I believe in evidence-based public policy. And evidence-based public policy is the opposite of wishful thinking. And with that in mind, let me confront you with four pieces of bad news this morning, and then I'll give you some good news. The first piece of bad news is the latest issue of the Journal of Economic Literature surveys all the studies of hospital report cards and other quality reporting measures and concludes that the evidence just isn't there, that the benefits exceed the costs. And they go out of their way to point out how hospital reporting and other kinds of reporting can actually cause quality to go down, just as teachers will teach to the test if that's the way they're paid. Doctors will practice medicine to the test if that's the way they're paid, and if you're the patient, that may not be good for you. The latest comprehensive survey of all the studies of electronic medical records concludes they're just not delivering on their promises. Number three, the latest study on pay-for-performance medicine from Britain says it just isn't working in that country. And the fourth piece of bad news, maybe the most important of all that I want to bring to you, is that in some ways, low-cost, high-quality health care is like pornography. And I didn't get that from a study. It comes from experience. They're like in the sense that we think we know it when we see it, but we can't define it. And not only can we not define it, but we can't even list the characteristics that you would need to have in order to produce it. Now, there is a study done here at Brookings that looked at high-performing hospital regions across the country, and they listed their characteristics, and lo and behold, I couldn't find, Mark, when I looked through your study, any objective characteristics that they had in common. In other words, some had electronic medical records, some didn't. Some had doctors on staff, some paid fee-for-service. So if I just ask the question, well, how can I be a high-quality, high-performing hospital region? The answer is we don't know. So now let me quickly turn to the good news to balance off the bad. If we look at all the markets surrounding the third-party payer system, all the markets where predominantly we have patients paying with their own money, things actually look pretty good. In the market for cosmetic and LASIK surgery, we have price competition, quality competition, transparency over the last decade, real costs going down, quality going up. Now, I know in an audience like this, you all are too young and too well-preserved to know much about these two markets, but they bear looking at because they're working well. Same thing can be said for the market for medical tourism, both internationally and in the United States. And we do have a growing market for tourism in the United States. It's just that you all don't get to take advantage of it. The Canadians can come here and get package prices. We can't unless we're willing to travel. The online market for drugs and medical tests, you have price competition, transparency. At least in the drug area, the quality seems better. The error rate is lower than it is at the local pharmacies. The walk-in clinics, the telephone and email consultation services, and the New York Times tells us this morning the concierge doctors are all using electronic medical records. They prescribe electronically, not because they were required to do so or subsidized or nudged to do so. It's because these are essential parts of their business plan. So what I'm describing to you right now are markets that work really pretty well. In fact, if the whole healthcare system worked as well as these markets, we wouldn't be here talking about the things that we're talking about today. Now, within the third-party system, we have what I would describe as a sea of mediocrity, punctuated by little islands of excellence scattered almost randomly. And Elliot and others here have studied these little islands of excellence, and some of them look really, really good. Now, all this is good news in the sense that, from my perspective, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here. There's a lot of ways that Medicare can substantially reduce its costs simply by taking advantage of what's already out there, not by going and creating something new. For example, we could start tomorrow and pay the market price at all the MinuteClinics for every Medicare enrollee in the country. And since the studies show that these MinuteClinics have higher quality, they're more consistent in the service they provide, they have lower money prices, lower time prices, than the competitors. We could not only start paying for all of that, but we could charge Medicare enrollees more if they went to the emergency room or to other more costly places for the same kinds of services. Now, if somebody said to me, well, you know, that'd be politically hard to do. Well, if you can't take the low-hanging fruit and pay more for what you like and less for what you don't like, if you can't do that, then it's most improbable that you're going to be able to get to the top of the tree and do the really hard things. Same thing for the telephone consulting services. That would seem to be almost a no-brainer. The money price is lower. The time price is lower than the alternatives. Within the third-party payer system, if Geisinger wants to offer a warranty on his heart surgery so you don't pay again if you have a readmission, then we ought to pay Geisinger more for the initial surgery. That's a deal we really can't afford to turn down. If Virginia Mason wants to offer us a deal so that all the back pain patients go to the therapist first and then to the MRI machine, we ought to be able to pay more for that kind of therapy because that would appear to save us money. And here again, if we're going to pay more for what we like, we can afford at the same time to pay less for what we don't like. If the pharmacists want to do what the pharmacists have done in Asheville, North Carolina, and give consultations to diabetic patients, we ought to be able to pay more for that kind of services or start paying for it, period. And if that appears to work, again, we can pay less for the kinds of physician services that we think do not work as well. So what I'm talking about here is going after the obvious ways in which, or obvious to me at least, where we can save money, and a lot of money, I would think. And in the process of doing so, we should send out a notice to every doctor, every hospital, every provider in the whole country, and say, look, we're open for business. And the parameters are, you know, you want to be paid a different way, you have to lower the cost to the taxpayer, you have to raise the quality for the patient, and you have to suggest a way that we would know a year out or 2 years out how we're going to measure this or how we're going to make some determination that you're doing what you said you would do. And as long as we stay within those parameters, it seems to me that we ought to be open to business. We ought to be open to everything that the providers know. Now, I've always believed that no one in Washington knows how to lower costs and raise quality in Tyler, Texas. But lots of people in Tyler know a lot of things about Tyler, and they probably have all kinds of ideas about how to lower costs and raise quality. So instead of us telling them what to do, let's let them tell us what they're prepared to do, and if it saves us money and raises the quality of care to the patient, then we're all better off, even if they're the only place in the country that's doing what they do. Those are my quick thoughts, Mike.
Great. John, thank you very much. Thanks. Gene, I'd like to turn to you next. You all have some direct experience recently with trying to reform the way that care is delivered, with an emphasis on some of the things, at least, that John emphasized, telephone consults, emails, more concierge-type physician availability through your practice, and it's supported by some of the payment reforms in the Blue Cross of Massachusetts alternative quality contract. So I think your perspectives on all these issues we've been talking about today, how do we get to what I think everybody on this panel has emphasized, which is, look, there are a lot of ways out there that clearly can lead to better results for patients, better patient experience, and save money at the same time. We just don't seem to be doing it as much as we like. How do we get from here to there, and your perspective on that experience?
Thank you. I'd like to begin, I guess, as positioning myself sort of as a foot soldier reporting from the fronts of battle in Massachusetts, where, in fact, we have challenged ourselves to be a pilot, literally, for the rest of the country, in terms of discovering that there is an outer limit to what we can afford to pay for health care. And I think really underlining the absolute genius and importance of the triple aim, and Don can change the name of it if he wants to, but I should tell you a little bit about our organization, because the HUC was a trip home for us, not a new adventure. We are the legacy practice of the old Harvey Community Health Plan, and when Dr. Ebert started the Harvey Community Health Plan in 1969, while he was dean of the Harvard Medical School, he made a speech where he made a statement something to the effect that we couldn't solve the healthcare dilemmas, and he was talking about those of 1969, by spending more money, hiring more people, building more resources, that we literally had to come up with a better operating system, a better approach to healthcare. And we spent the last 40 years proving that he was right. And, you know, sort of like Churchill said, you can count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried all the wrong things. And so we're back to trying what Dr. Ebert tried to introduce to us more than 40 years ago. We, I think, have had some significant success, but we shouldn't be too proud of ourselves. We're somewhat like Kaiser Light. I mean, we've had an automated medical record since 1969, always at the upper limit of what the technology could offer. And so we have had for many years patients on electronic patient portals through our Epic system. But what we have learned over the last 40 years, I think, would totally underline what the first panel focused on, which is that if you're going to successfully manage care and if you're going to make any difference at all in terms of achieving the triple aim, that your first focus has to be on the therapeutic relationship with the people who come to you for service. And we are reiterating the importance of that to ourselves through the AQC, the Alternative Quality Contract, which has many domains in it that measure things from the effectiveness that we manage patients with diabetes and hypertension, but also focus very specifically on the experience of care as well. And sort of facetiously, I've gotten to the place where the only thing that's important to me about attribution is the data. I really, really don't believe that it's important for the patient to have contractual change that keep us to the practice. If we can't win their allegiance by the quality of the service that we offer them, then I don't think we have any success in assuming risk. By having a tight relationship with our patients, in the last 2 years, we've been able to do some remarkable things as we've been seeking to be successful within the AQ. So we've moved huge amounts of clinical activity from one large teaching institution to another, where we felt that the care was better integrated, That required a relationship with our patients that couldn't have been achieved by just them being assigned to us. They had to have a relationship with us to be able to trust their doctor in moving from one facility to another. And in fact, we've transferred lots of care from tertiary hospitals to community hospitals, again, recognizing that what the patients want is a relationship with their physician that actually is meaningful, and actually that they want care that's convenient, closer to home. And if they feel that their quality is high, and our scores in Massachusetts in terms of quality and commercial contracts is the highest there is, then in fact they're willing to do what we need them to do to be able to accept risk. I will also say that unless the physicians in the institutions understand that there is a downside to a lack of performance, I think it's highly unlikely that there will ever be any change in performance. And I say that from, I think, a pretty significant wellspring of experience. I've calculated up that I think I've had more than 150,000 patient encounters, either in hospital or office. So I know of what I speak in terms of how you interact with people to lead them to a position of it being easier for them to have health care, which in essence is what we're trying to accomplish. So I think the HUC, to get back to your initial question, has been very helpful for us because, in fact, we have, since Helen Hunt put a dagger in the heart of managed care, back in that movie, As Good as It Gets, you know, we've sort of been aliens in the land of fee-for-service. In fact, we used to call it free-for-service because we were so bad at it, because the only thing that we knew was managed care, that we literally had to go the reverse trip. Instead of learning how to accept risk, we had to learn how to build budgets based on encounters and revenue. So the sad thing is that we're now in a position where we have a whole new generation of physicians who never have had to manage in a managed care environment and are having to relearn it from the gray heads in the organization who remember the mid-70s, mid-80s, and the late 80s, and have the deep reflection from the mistakes of the early 90s. So as we've approached the AQC, we've really discovered the joy of trying to reestablish a meaningful relationship with our practice, focusing on achievable things in terms of the domains of quality that have been established for us, and recognizing that if we don't do it, there is a financial downside. And I think that that more than anything enables us to engage in the real work that's necessary to move from, it's an easy thing to say, volume to value. Trust me, having gone into fee-for-service for the last 15 years in a very significant way, it's almost like substance abuse. You literally have to reprogram your mind to begin to think about delivering care to populations within a budget. I mean, you build your budgets on encounters and on the number of clicks from your RADONC and things of that sort, rather than actually approaching the budget from the point of view of what do these people need and how can we deploy ourselves in a fashion that's efficient and will achieve what they want, which is a personalized health care that's of the highest quality. So the AQC has given us the structure to think about that, and our desire, hopefully, is to, in very short order, return to what the image of the Payment Reform Commission in Massachusetts was, which is 100% global payment delivered through nothing but ACOs. So that's our goal, and I hope within my lifetime it will be achievable. We have about 800 physicians, 1,250 other healthcare professionals delivering care to about 700,000 people in eastern Massachusetts within this paradigm that I've just described. Hopefully later this year, our affiliation will extend all the way out through central Massachusetts, and we'll have about 1 million patients getting care that's organized around the thought process that I've just been describing. I will say that the technical attributes that we have, including data warehouses, the automated medical records, and managers that understand or can dimly remember how we once did it, are important assets that we're trying to share with our community. Everyone's referenced Atul Gawande's article. I have to put in this plug. Don spent the first 12 years of his career in our organization. Glenn Steele spent an equal amount of time with us at about the same time. And our most recent famous graduate is Atul, who practiced ambulatory endocrine and general surgery in our facility before he moved his activities completely into the external world. But nevertheless, his article last week pointed to Verisk as a tool. So we've invested also in this software that will, I think, in a complementary fashion, will help us get even closer to those hot spots within our practice. You know, you might remember from the story the woman with $50,000 worth of migraine headaches, which wasn't because she was an abuser of the system, it was because she was getting fragmented care. And we know that even at this moment, there are cases like that within our practice that we have to find and change if we're going to eventually deliver, I think, on the prospects of what the AQC has to offer. So I'll leave off there.
Great. Thanks for those comments. And maybe Gene and Ed, I could stick with you all for a minute. I want to do a follow-up with the Johns here. You all talked at some length about both the payment reforms you've implemented and the care delivery changes that have taken place. John earlier went through a pretty compelling litany of lack of evidence in general of efforts to try to improve quality, whether it's by supporting EHRs across the board or just reporting on quality. Why has your experience been different? Why are you confident that you're actually achieving significant improvements in quality of care and reductions in costs? You both mentioned the downside risk as being an important element of this, but it sounds like there were some other key elements too. So what's been most important in that?
I think the most recent understanding that we've had is that it's not just technical change we're talking about, but adaptive change, and that we actually have to have real conversations with our physicians about what's expected of them. Why were we doing this? There's been help in the lay press in Massachusetts when you realize that the last $1 billion of money given to public education in Massachusetts ended up paying for health care premiums rather than for teachers. You begin to recognize that we've really hit the upper limit of what we can spend on health care in our community and expect to have a community that we're proud to live in. And I think that getting our physicians to understand that this is a professional, a civic responsibility, and the public really isn't interested in how bad their lives are, how threatened they feel by economic change. But in fact, it's the other way around, that it's the community that's threatened by us unless we can change, I think is a first step. But that is a very difficult position for physicians to come face to face with. But there's a tipping point, you know, these sorts of conversations where people begin to get it and then get excited about resolving the problem. And I think we've gotten there. We focused on the positive deviants in our practice, those folks who just sort of innately knew how to do it, and we've gone and asked them what they were doing and then tried to transfer what we've learned from them to other people. We've been using tools like lean process management and things of that sort also to help us reawaken the creativity that's associated with the practice of medicine for a lot of our clinicians and staff. Those have all been, you know, things that have helped.
Okay. So I think that what has really helped drive the success that we've had is maybe a more simple explanation. It started really with transparency. And because this was an arrangement that involved our biggest customer, CalPERS, we have a very transparent relationship with CalPERS, and that we basically opened up those same books to the provider partner. So we quickly got over the concern that the providers were going to do all this work and it was just going to enrich the bottom line of the, you know, evil insurance company. And it was a really open book. And then for the hospital and the physician group, in conjunction with our organization, to be able to look at the total results of the population that was now under this arrangement and to see what was happening and have the complete picture and be able to collaboratively work around making changes, that really is what drove the results. And I think, this whole idea of lock in or not lock in. I think, you know, if you live in California and you're part of an HMO, I've been for, you know, at least 20 years, probably longer than that, you don't necessarily feel locked in because, you know, every year you get to change and, you know, there's probably a bunch of other ways you can move. So the other part of this was to make sure that, you know, Kaiser is another alternative in that area, and they do a great job, and they're tough competition that keeps people motivated, and they had to be able to, you know, have an arrangement, a coordination of the care that people found attractive, that they would, you know, join that arrangement, and word of mouth would spread and you know, make it more popular. So I think it's been a combination of some indicators that have really been very positive, you know, shorter lengths of stay, a lot lower readmissions to hospitals, more people joining through word of mouth that it's, you know, it seems to be working, that have really helped make it successful.
Okay, thanks. And I want to go back to some basic points that I think both Johns alluded to about if we're talking about what the real goal is here, which is getting providers to come forward more with where they've got ideas on how to improve quality and lower costs, and recognize that those aren't just going to be lost because of regulations, third-party payments, other barriers to actually implementing real reforms in care. And throughout the morning, everybody's emphasized that, you know, if the overall goal is improve quality and lower costs, a lot of those ideas, if not most of those ideas, are going to come from providers out in the community changing, you know, in the trenches, changing the way they deliver care. But the second component of this that John emphasized, and that's really behind a lot of the ACO focus that we've been discussing today, is having a way to measure that. So providers coming forward with a way to measure that, presumably having some agreement between the providers and the payers. So as you said, there's transparency. As Ed said, that there's transparency, and all these things can happen at once. Like some final or some further reflections from both of you about how, you know, what's it going to take to really make that happen based on the experiences that we've seen around the country.
Sure. So let me start with TACO, the Tucson ACO that is still a prototype. But I think part of it went live on January 1st. And the docs there working with Tucson Medical Center. So in many ways, it's different from Kaiser, different from your legacy system there, because it's developed with community providers and under the umbrella organization of the sponsoring hospital. The docs say, we know how to save money. We know how to keep people out of the emergency rooms. In particular, we know how to reduce the readmissions. And I have to tell you that sitting in the room, the senior hospital people are all highly in favor of this, and the hospital's CFO kind of gulps and says, yes, I know hospital revenue is going to go down. But because it's a nonprofit with a strong community mission, he's been convinced. And I think their process of going forward on that basis to do the right things, as in reducing cost with probably what I think Gene would say very simple things for getting the first low-hanging fruit, is on its way to being successful. And
did come, John, with these changes in payment.
Yes.
And, you know, while the simple things, you know, may seem simple from the provider standpoint, it's often not so simple to get the reimbursement to keep up with that, to have confidence that these steps are really enough confidence that the actuaries and the payers are really going to put their money where their mouth is behind, not just saying they want to back these changes from individual providers, but they're really supporting them.
Yes, this is absolutely the case. We are cooperating with one of the biggest payers in town, UnitedHealthcare in this case, who has gone forward and saying, yes, we're willing to do gain sharing. I think probably much the same way that Ed and Blue Shield are cooperating on in the Sacramento area with CalPERS. So it's very important to have a cooperative payer.
I don't think we would have made the progress we've made without the cooperation of the payers in our market. And, you know, the HUC is the from Blue Cross is the one that's gotten the most press, but we've had other significant positive relationships with payers, the other payers in the market. I think they're each approaching the concern slightly differently, but with the same fundamental principles. And we're all, I think, learning that, in fact, if we ask our physicians and patients what it is they need help doing, that, in fact, they're beginning to get the understanding that things have to change. And I think there's a moment of hope that's beginning to sort of well up from all of the cacophony, you know, about this and that. I mean, it's really pretty simple in the end. It's, you know, don't do the things that don't work. Do the things that do work. And if you don't know which it is, try to understand. And to treat everyone, you know, with the sort of dignity and respect that you would treat a family member. I mean, it can be reduced to some pretty simple sorts of approaches.
And John, I take your point about these parts of the healthcare system where there is no third-party payment, but where you need this, as others have talked about, this alignment between what the payers are willing to pay for and what the providers really think matters for changing care. Any further thoughts on how to make that happen?
Yeah, I think there are two things that are really, really hard for most people to understand. And one of them is if we can spot things that we think are really good, like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or Taco or whatever, and it looks great, and you just think, well, why can't we just copy that? Why can't we just do a cookie cutter of what we see and that we like? And the answer is because we don't know how to do that. And if it helps in thinking through that, remember, we've been trying to do this in education for 25 years. For 25 years, we've been trying to copy stuff that works, and we have not been able to do it. So that's point number one. Point number two is whatever works today is probably not what's going to work 10 years from now. And so if you lock people in, you give them a global budget, and you say you got to practice medicine this way, then you have an organization that does not have the flexibility to change over time. And I think what's going to happen, I haven't said this yet, but one more aside. I think we're going to have a huge, huge rationing problem in 4 years. The demand for healthcare is just going to soar. We've done nothing on the supply side. People are going to not want to wait in line as long as they're going to be forced to wait. And I think we're going to see a huge exodus from the system. The Mayo Clinics are just going to leave it all together, and so are a lot of doctors. And outside the system, we're going to have a lot of stuff happening that you all will like. You'll have electronic medical records. You'll have all kinds of neat stuff, and it will change over time. And my prediction is that the most admirable things that happen over the next 10 years will probably happen outside the system, not within the system.
Interesting. I know we're close to the end of our time. I'd like to open this up for some comments and questions from those of you here. So once again, we've got the microphones present in the audience. Anyone with a comment or question before we break? See, over here.
Hi, John Houghton from Covisint. The question or comment is about whether we know what to do is one piece of it, and then the second is, can the ACOs end up in a place where they really separate the gain sharing on the quality of care and the actuarial risk and the reserves that torqued a bunch of physician groups a long time ago and was alluded to in terms of the fiscal diligence that needed to be is happening in California. So in terms of the elements of knowing what to do, it seems like the articles like Kawamoto's and others said that really there are about three things you do. You know the population, you get lists of patients who are falling through the cracks, and you get what's needed at the point of care for the communication. And those details are now getting incented on the oxide. And so will that make care end up working better? And then the second question is, do you guys think a single or a group of physicians without reserves, without audited accounting, can end up playing in this game if there's a gain share versus holding the actuarial risk and having full capitation?
I think maybe start with John for that, and if anyone else has comments too. And if you could, you know, specifically talk about this issue of, I think, smaller groups and groups that don't have a lot of integration, groups that, I think, to John's point, may have some better ideas about how to do things, but it may be hard for them to show it and to, you know, sort of take on some of the accountability we've just discussed.
So I'm going to start by perhaps recalling what Mark said, with three levels of risk here, bonus only or a symmetric upside downside. Who is the organization or the entity that holds that risk? For Medicare, it's still CMS. And so you don't have the fairly stringent things that happen that Ed and I are familiar with from the 90s in California. But secondly, as part of having an ACO, I think Mark and Elliot have all been proponents of having that infrastructure that's needed to record what's going on, both in the electronic medical records for clinical stuff, but also in collecting the data and budgets and where they are. Actual to budget is what actuaries call it, and being able to monitor that as we go along. So there are organizations there. That article on advocates that was in the most recent Health Affairs is a good example of it. But there are a number of other organizations, many of them capitated today, that do that. But the infrastructure and the components are out there. They can be rented by ACOs rather than having to develop them from scratch.
The question was, can you separate out the capitation, the holding of the financial risk, from the gain-sharing quality improvement? And so basically you say, here the
power of the pen is to make that change in care coordination, but a lot of those smaller groups or IPAs just simply don't have capital structures that allow them to take risk. And are we in a place where now you can separate those? So CMS can say, we'll take the actuarial risk, and we'll gain share with you, maybe even symmetrically up and down, but you're not risking the overall expense of the population. You're risking the delta that you're willing to take responsibility on.
I'm very positive that you can, and I think we have several natural experiments occurring in our market where this is the case. I don't think that every physician should be accepting full risk. I think we have assets that have been developed over years, and even in that context feel, you know, always sort of marginally the breath of the possibility of financial failure on our necks. You know, we have the reinsurance and all those other sorts of mechanisms. But what's happening, part of the interest that we have in affiliating with like-minded folks in central Massachusetts is that they have been reaching out to one and twosies in that rural, more rural environment, and extending to them, without bringing them into their organization, access to their automated medical record. And we've actually created a coalition of folks that meet in central Massachusetts that bring smaller groups in from all the way out to the New York border, where we are beginning to have conversations, sort of self-help groups, about the nuts and bolts of some of the technical change, and also sort of, if any of you remember bailant groups from the 60s, maybe I'm dating myself, where physicians got together to talk about the angst of practice. That can actually happen at the group level. So sharing best practices, transferring best practices, which is essentially what Atul's been doing in all of his articles. I mean, he's been just showing that somebody someplace can do it, and if they can do it in Camden, why can't you do it in Worcester, you know, type of conversations, I think are very, very important. And we shouldn't pull the rug out from under that by saying that this is hopeless and we can't do it, because I do believe there's a momentum that's developing. You can feel it beginning to happen in Massachusetts. Interesting thing happened the other night on WGBH. Emily Rudy, the daughter of Art Rooney, has a television program. And so she brings on the president of the Mass Medical Society and a physician representing a group that does accept the AQC. And the idea is to create some conflict here, right? By the end of the conversation, they were saying the same thing. And they had come together and coalesced around the realities that they both understood about the practice and the issues that she had hoped, I guess, create some tension for an interesting audience experience, actually resolved into sort of a love fest around the idea that we had to do this. So I think that when that sort of experience occurs, you know, it gives heart to people who actually are trying to deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis.
Interesting. Time for one more quick question up here.
Thank you. My name is Gordon Litwin from Meridian Health System. In the financial markets, everybody talks about the need for predictability and stability. In the healthcare, I haven't heard today any discussion of the long-term resolution of these problems. We're talking about innovation, but for example, if you talk about the electronic health record and you talk about the subsidy program for the physician component of that, right now, while we're writing the regulations for meaningful use, the money for the physician component is to some extent at risk based on certain political situations that have appear to be rearing, that view coming forward. And then secondly, with gain sharing as a component of accountable care, you find the medical community concerned as they get into it and the low-hanging fruit is obtained, what happens in the long term? So what is the long term? How do you resolve the long-term stability issues in dealing with the innovative solutions that you're seeking?
May I make a prediction?
Please do.
All right, here's my quick prediction. That most of the insurers in the exchanges and in the employer market are going to go to what's called reference pricing. And they're going to say, you go to our doctor and our hospital, we'll pay for everything. You go anywhere else, and you pay the marginal cost. Now, what's going to happen is everybody with money is going to go someplace else, and we're going to have a huge explosion of concierge doctors, concierge facilities, people essentially outside the insurance system, with insurance paying maybe the bulk of the fee, but the market really responding to patients paying the marginal cost.
So, thoughts on this?
Yeah. One thing that was very encouraging for me in as a result of this pilot that we undertook was the leadership of the CHW hospitals really, it's almost like the light bulb went on and they said, you know, we are going to have to find a way to live within what we get paid by Medicare for our Medicare patients. You know, the days of cost shifting will, you know, come to an end. And, you know, I've heard people describe they've now started to really think differently about how they budget, how they go into their labor negotiations, and, you know, with a real goal in the organization to, you know, lower the cost, their piece of the cost, you know, that goes into this this whole equation. And I think, you know, that's got to happen across the board. And then I think what will be left is kind of the growth in chronic conditions that we're suffering from obesity and all the other conditions that are going to have to be dealt with because that keeps pressure on the system. Even if you are very efficient in the way you deliver care, sicker people, you know, just increase the demand.
I think this panel's done a terrific job of bringing out some of the core issues and challenges in healthcare reform, especially from the provider side, which was our focus. So on the one hand, we are facing these enormous cost pressures with a lot of evidence of inefficiency, lost opportunities to improve health, and deliver higher value care. On the other hand, some real concerns, and this came up on the first panel too, that being too aggressive or too ham-fisted or taking too much of a sledgehammer approach to trying to reduce costs is going to lead to some real problems with innovative quality care, which if you talk to the American public, seems to be their biggest concern about them and their loved ones getting access to high-quality, innovative care. So there's some good discussions about the way forward to address these challenges, but by no means are these resolved. I do think, though, that we've taken this discussion towards another level of concreteness. These are problems that are not going away. The challenge of innovative care on the one hand, the challenge of reducing costs at the same time, and there seem to be a lot of support behind finding better ways to, whether it's through ACOs or other payment reforms or all of them, hopefully in combination synergistically, to help providers identify and get support for steps that they can take to really improve care and lower costs and have that accountability, the way, as John said, of measuring it confidently, go along with it so that we can get the confidence of the public and we can spend our money as effectively as possible. So I want to thank all of you for an excellent discussion here. I'm going to invite Elliot back up to make just some brief concluding remarks before we break. While he's coming up, I also want to thank the whole Dartmouth team for co-hosting this event and also the Engelberg Center staff that really did as I talked about real health care reform earlier, there's also real work to make these kinds of events happen. Larry Cocott, Beth Rafferty, Cindy Chen, Todd Wintner, Aaron Weirder, Tucker Page, Josh Pfeiffer, and Sean McBride, who was up late emailing with me last night. I want to thank all of them for making it possible, as well as all of our panelists and all of you for getting here to make this an excellent discussion. Thank you all very much. And just some final words from Elliot.
I just want to thank you all for coming. This is such an important
moment. It was wonderful to hear Don with us this morning to talk about his vision for the future. I think we heard some wonderful specific things from our panel about consumer engagement, about all the things Deborah told us that are possible. This was a spectacular panel. We have a great responsibility and opportunity to our children to make this work. I will remind you that the toolkit is available on the web. I hope you'll all download it, share it with your friends. We're trying to take this, the learning network that we've created, and really use it as an opportunity to go learn from our participating hospitals, the pilot sites, and then share that with as many people as possible. We have a lot to learn. We're absolutely right. I would remember Yogi Berra's, you know, what was Yogi Berra's statement? You know, prediction is really difficult, especially about the future. So it really is in our hands what we want to make of all this, and I think we have a tremendous moment. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is good. So here's what I'd like to write with you.